Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
This week on Meatin' 3, we celebrate Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month with an episode about memory.
I've always read and sort of approached cookbooks for more than the recipes. To me, they are full of narrative content and narrative value.
So Malama Aina basically means to take care of the land. For us as Hawaiians, it's taking care of our older sibling.
But I do remember like definitely feeling like self-conscious about it, like being the only one who kind of wasn't eating a sandwich and like didn't have a bag of goldfish or Lunchables.
Listen to Meatin' 3 wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so here we are at Cooking in Mexican from A to Z with myself, Aaron Sanchez, my lovely mother, Salida Martinez, and we have the unbelievable honor of bringing to our podcast someone that I admire immensely. I say if there's someone that is comparable to my mom and her unbelievable force of nature as far as making sure that our cuisine and our culture is preserved and honored and celebrated, it's Maricel Presilla. She is somebody that I just admire, I respect, I learn from her at all times. And while we have my tia, we're just going to call her tia for right now, we're going to be talking about all things recados, okay? That wonderful seasoning paste that's used, yes, in the Yucatan part or Quintana Roo part of Mexico. But I have a feeling, because we all know each other so well, that the conversation is going to sort of go in many different directions. But first, I want to welcome Maricel Presilla. Muchísimas gracias, querida tía. Gracias por estar aquí con nosotros. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Aaron, mi querido sobrino. And Sarela, mi hermana, my sister, seeing you is definitely a pleasure. You are my family and you represent so much of my career in the culinary world. I am pleased for another reason, because I see this as a very important project. It's not just, that I see mother and son collaborating on something that is so dear to both of you, but I think it's important. It's an important legacy for your family and for Mexicans who are all over the world right now. And inviting me to come and speak about spices is even, more important mm-hmm. for me, because this is something that I have been studying essentially all my life.
That's why you're on here, honey.
I'm a former medievalist, and so when you are a medievalist interested in the cuisines of Europe and the old world, obviously spices feature prominently, and how spices got into European kitchens, and then how spices travel to the new world and were incorporated into the many cuisines of our part of the world. So it's really a very substantial an important topic. People need to understand the complexity of our cuisines, and the use of spices, the clever, intelligent use of spices in Latin American cooking is something that maybe people take for granted. Maybe they focus too much
on cumin,
our use of capsicums, but not on the clever and layered use of seasonings to get to a great harmonious effect.
Because in the North, everybody thinks of cumin as being the only spice,
Exactly.
But then in Central Mexico, I always think of that combination of one part cinnamon, one part cumin, and one quarter part of cloves as the classic Mexican spice combination. Where does that come from?
So, well, you know, you're talking about the DNA of a particular region, you know, that comes through in the interplay of different spices. You know, if you're talking about the DNA of Cuban cooking, but Cuban cooking from my part of Cuba, which is Santiago de Cuba, is in the eastern part of the island, heavily influenced by Haiti and Jamaica. Well, we need to talk about cumin, but also allspice.
Oh, really?
Yes. If you look at my marinades, adobos, I always use allspice. But if you look at the marinades of other parts of my island, which is a small island, they don't use it. They have cumin, oregano, but I use allspice because we're so close to Haiti and Jamaica.
And la pimienta gorda, no?
Right? Yeah. La pimienta gorda, la pimienta de Chiapas.
Well, could I interject something there? That is the only native Mexican spice that there is. And when I was doing my series in Veracruz, they were harvesting and they would put it out in the sun every day. And you would hear the rakes moving it every day until so they would.
And the smell, yeah. The incredible
smell,
incredible aroma.
And the people there use the leaves as seasoning.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And also the bark, you know, it's a plant related to myrtle. And, you know, every part of the plant has aroma and has culinary uses. So it's part of my DNA because you will always find allspice in my adobos, in my marinades. So the way in which we deploy spices, how we mix them on a dish, can tell a lot about who we are as cooks, but also about the forces that created our cuisines.
Yeah.
So you asked me where these things come from. And obviously, if you were talking about cinnamon and cumin and oregano, not the Mexican oregano, which is related to the verbena, is different. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a false oregano. We have to look at the old world, and we have to look at the conquistadores coming into the land that we know today as Mexico, their new Spain, and bringing these elements of flavor, but through a process because it did not happen immediately. So you have to understand the first Spaniards who set food in Mexico with Cortes came from actually my hometown. They were Spaniards who had settled in Santiago de Cuba, and then they sailed with Cortes and they ended up there. So what did they bring? They brought yuca bread, dry beef, stuff like that. So they did not bring the nice and aromatic spices that they were used to in Spain. Mm-hmm. That happened later in waves.
I think that at this point, what would be really helpful is what spice combinations are assigned to like different ethnicities that come to Mexico. Like for instance, the Afro-Mexican cuisine includes the cumin and the cilantro seeds. And you know, the different groups use different spice combinations. And Yucatan uses all of them at one time.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, but I think that's a good point. Let's talk a little bit about what a recado is. I think that's important to maybe define that. Because, you know, Tia, I can hear you talk about spices all day. And that idea.
Recado. I love that word. I love that word, recado.
And recado is kind of like a metaphor, you know, for like, you know what I mean? You know, to like marinate yourself and get really tasty and delicious.
It's more than that. It's you know, I mean, it has this essential connotation. I mean, called recado.
Yeah.
It's used in many parts of Latin America, not only in Mexico. But you know what it means, you know, and this is something that I investigated, you know, I researched it. It comes, you know, it's an old term, and it has to do with that which is necessary.
Wow.
Recado means
wow.
That which
is necessary. But it also is a message. A recado is a message.
It's a message, but in culinary terms, and when you say, and he, for example, a gaucho. Mm-hmm. Could have slept on his recado, meaning on his saddle, you know, just put the saddle on the ground. But that was what he needed. You know, it's what someone needs. So in a culinary sense, it's that which you need to give flavor to food.
And just for all of our listeners, a recado is a paste or is it a powdered mixture?
It's usually a paste.
Yeah, it's a paste, right? But in essence, can you get all of the ingredients?
In the Yucatecan connotation, yes, it is a paste.
Mm-hmm.
But you can find it in the islands, in Puerto Rico, el recado might be, you know, a combination of cilantro, culantro, with that tiny sweet pepper, ají dulce.
Mm-hmm.
It's called recado. Maybe the cilantro is called recadito. So, I mean, all these words are, you know, sort of navigating, you know, in Latin America. But in the Yucatecan term, it's, you know, recado is a paste.
Yeah.
So recado rojo, yeah. Negro, etc.
Well, in South of Veracruz, they grow bunches of hierbas de guisar,
mm-hmm.
you know, which are curantro, cilantro, and other herbs. And then they just grow together like John does it, like John Mooney does it. Mm-hmm. So people just grab it and sell it. And it's got the bay leaves. It's just a wonderful thing. Because at that part, they don't use spices that much. They use this hierbas de guisar.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an important part to mention just for the home cook that's listening. People don't understand that herbs need to be cooked out. I think people associate herbs being used in seasoning paste as something that should be thrown in at the last moment because of the chlorophyll and the freshness element. But there are herbs that deserve to be added in the early cooking process of dishes.
Yeah, of course.
Give me an example, Aaron.
And an example for me would be culantro, the saw leaf herb.
No, but she's talking about the dish.
Oh, a dish. I will give you an example. You would put something, you know, the rosemary, the thyme, all the wood herbs, but you would throw that in the earlier cooking part of the process if you're doing a braise or a pozole or starting like a bean mixture, for instance. And one of the things that I started to do is like I wanted to start soaking beans, but I want to char vegetables and char these woody herbs and let that be part of my soaking liquid. You see what I'm saying? So the actual soaking liquid has flavor.
So what you're doing there is that you're talking about layering, which I think is the crucial aspect of most Latin American cooking, and particularly Mexican, is that layered flavor.
Exactly.
So in the case of culantro, I like to use culantro at the beginning, especially for beans, you know, that broad leaf culantro, different than cilantro, you know, Eryngium fetidum. Because it's so tough, I add it to the beans, you know, even whole, you know, just I don't chop it, I just add it whole. But also what I do is that I add these herbs and seasonings at different moments in the cooking. So I might start some dish with some of these herbs, but then at the end I might add a little bit of the fresh ones, you know, for sort of more pungent.
Just like my mom, after every dish was finished, she would grind up a head of garlic with a little bit of salt and put it in the dish.
There you are, layering layer.
So flavor. You always had the flavor of the raw garlic, which is so good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was really good. So. I don't know. I think it's interesting about who uses the cooking paste and who uses the spices. And I wonder what that's due to, because, I mean, the Spanish came here to find spices.
Mm-hmm.
And they only found the chili.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and allspice.
And you would say, Dia, you would say that a lot of that came from their time in the Caribbean, picking up influences on their way to the New World, right? Well, I mean, the Caribbean is in the world,
Obviously, you know, you're talking about the Greater Antilles, and mm-hmm. that's, you know, with Hispaniola, you know, today, Dominican Republic and Haiti, that's, you know, and Cuba.
Mm.
So these are the places where they found particular ingredients, including the capsicums, you know, that they took back to Spain, but also in this Caribbean stage of the process of conquest, they found allspice.
Mm. Well, I always say that when the Spanish conquered Mexico, it had only been 100 years since the Moors had been expelled.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the spice combinations like the cinnamon, cumin, and cloves are very completely Moorish. And, you know, there's a lot of dishes, particularly in Veracruz, that are completely Moorish. You know, like that almond soup,
mm-hmm.
you know, so... I think that's one of the influences that's not discussed as much in Mexican food, you know, the Moorish influence.
Absolutely. You know, we are, you know, we are a lab, we became the laboratory of intercontinental fusion, you know, in the Americas. And the settlers, the first colonial settlers from Spain, had this incredible cultural legacy, you know, from, you know, hundreds of years of Islamic influence. Obviously, you know, what Zarella points out, which is very important, is that these elements of Islamic cuisine were brought into the Americas. And the interesting thing is that we became repositories of an ancient culinary tradition that links Spain with the Mediterranean and beyond. And certain dishes remained that way, whereas in Spain, they disappeared.
Oh, really?
The complexity disappeared in the Iberian Peninsula, not completely, but it did. I mean, the use of spices just was not as important as it was in the medieval and Renaissance period. Things changed. But however, if we look at different cuisines in the Americas, particularly in Mexico, you find these ancient ways of cooking that were very Mediterranean. The use of almonds and bread. And if you look at mole, you will see that one of the ancestors of the mole as it was created out of a pre-Columbian, you know, combination of elements and in monastic institutions, you find these bread sauces and nut sauces from Spain.
Yeah.
It's part of the mole, or the mole making a technique, all right? So it's always important to remember who were the Spaniards at first, they settled the Americas and that went to live in Mexico. Who were the nuns, you know, and the monks that came in and interpreted cuisines, you know?
Let's talk about some iconic dishes that are made with recados, right? So our listeners can get a kind of grip on what
the Yucatecan. Now we're talking about the Yucatecan recado particularly, right?
Yeah, the cochinita pibil.
Oh my God, and the turkey, you know, the turkey with a mole negro, Zarella, in the Yucatan. Oh my God. The mole negro, no, the recado negro, what am I saying?
They had a very funny note, and we were doing some research on it. It said, do not open all the doors and windows when you're making recado negro, because everybody's going to come running over there wondering why you're trying to kill them. Because it's so spicy.
Well, I have to tell you, it is my favorite recado from the Yucatan. And I've eaten it with turkey. And in fact, you know, there was a recipe I tasted years ago that, you know, it's the turkey is cooked like in a pip, you know, pibil style, but with the recado negro. But then I made turkey meatballs, albóndigas de pavo with recado negro. It's, you know, the recipes in my book, Gran Cocina Latina. And I think it's the most complex and exciting seasoning mix.
Maybe you can share that recipe for our website. That would be wonderful.
Yeah, it's in Gran Cocina Latina, and I would love to do it.
I have a theory. Maybe you agree with me or not. That a lot of those dishes at that time, they used a lot of burnt things, you know, which brings, you know, it's a natural antacid. And I wonder how much of that, the carbon, I wonder how much of that was thought through, you know, that because there's so many moles and so many things that have burnt tortillas, burnt chilies, burnt everything.
I think it's a confluence of two cultures that had a similar idea about certain ingredients. You know, I know for a fact that this roasting and over roasting is also very Spanish, as well as pre-Columbian. But the Spaniards had this theory of humors, you know, this Greco-Roman theory of health. So, for example, if they were dealing with chiles, they thought the chiles were too hot for the body's humors, you know. And they, by toasting, they were counteracting something that was considered bad for your health.
What is the word in English? It's not humors. It's something else.
Humors. Humores in Spanish.
Yeah.
Well, this is all like so very interesting because they also have all these medicinal uses. You know, the spices is still, I mean, every time I feel something, I call my sister and she says, hoja de naranjo. You know, whatever it is, still curing with spices and and herbs, but mostly spices.
So just because you mentioned, Tia, a little bit of the Ricardo Negro, what are some of the traditional spices, ladies? I'm referring to you guys. I know, but I want you guys to share with our, what are some of the traditional spices in the Ricardo Negro? And it goes with turkey.
All spice. It's definitely
black pepper.
Black pepper. Yeah.
It's I believe that cinnamon is there too. Yeah.
And the idea is that you're taking something that has no inherent flavor, like a turkey or a chicken, which is
inherent flavor. Well, excuse me.
But it has an inherent
thing about turkey.
I know, but you are also growing them, but I'm talking about mass produced. Right? Because your turkeys and your fowl eat something with a specific diet. But if you're talking about mass-produced poultry now, you would want to complement that with something that has a lot of flavor and action-packed, no? With seasoning and flavor. Like, what are your thoughts about that? Because back, during the during the period when the Spaniards came, fowl had flavor. It ate all the little different things on the ground. But now, because it's mass produced, how do we combat that with?
Well, in Yucatan, there's a whole way of cooking that's very interesting. They double cook the things. They might grill a piece of turkey and then they finish it off in water with herbs and everything like that. Or they might do it backwards. They might take something that's cooked in a very flavorful broth and stuff, and then grill it and then serve it. Have you seen a lot of those dishes, Maricel?
I have encountered that. And in fact, I have to say that when I started interpreting some of these dishes for my own cooking, I would do that naturally. I would do that. But, I stopped doing it in a way. Because, I wanted to follow the recipes, more closely, but it was invariable that, even with mole, I would always hesitate to add a piece of, raw poultry or anything to a mole sauce. I would cook it before, or I would use the mole, on there, it's like, when I use duck, for example, yeah. Duck breast. And I sear that, and then I serve it on top of a bed of mole instead of dousing the duck with the sauce. But I don't do that. I don't do that as often. And in terms of the lack of flavor, there are plenty of heirloom birds that you can get now, Aaron. Really.
I know.
I cooked this beautiful heirloom turkey for Thanksgiving this year. It was so delicious. It was so intense in flavor. If you care about that intensity, you can find it. Pay for it, though, because it's expensive.
Well, that's what I was saying, Tia. It wasn't like I'm making a general... I'm just saying for the common, that doesn't have the common cook or someone at home that doesn't have access to those wonderful heritage birds, sometimes the flavors can be a little bit muted. They don't have the complexity. So that's all my only point. I didn't want to get anybody upset because I know you raised.
But I have an idea here that what I do with everything, that anything that needs it's a sauce, you're going to have some broth added. So, get the intensity from the broth, get your chicken bones or your poultry bones and just roast them the way I do and then make a great, a great stock.
Yeah.
That's what I do. I cook everything in stock. I cook vegetables in stock. Not intense ones, but
that does it.
Yeah, I do. I hardly ever use water to cook.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can we talk about the mole? I'm sorry. I keep calling it mole. Why is it? Because I want to talk about
the chote rojo.
No, Ricardo Rojo.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about that.
Vivil, which I think is another great condiment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's used so much.
And it's probably the most popular recado that's known universally, right? It has.
I remember when I was in Marimba, we used to have this baby chickens, with a recado rojo. And I remember that one of the customers asked me, "What does it taste like?" And I said, "Well, it has kind of like a earthy flavor." So then I go back to the table after she finished. I said, "So how did it taste?" She said, "It was great. It tasted just like dirt, just like you told me."
Just like dirt. I have to tell you, Sarela, excuse me, Aaron, but I have to reminisce. I met your mother at Café Marimba.
Wow.
When I was a historian, you know, working on my dissertation at New York University, and I went there with my husband. First of all, I have to tell you that I love the way the place looked, and I love the food, and I fell in love with the pato con pepian.
Oh, yeah.
Had a duck breast with pepian, and I have never, ever forgotten it. And then I needed to meet the chef, and that's how I met your mother.
Oh,
wow.
But it was out of my passion and love for that particular dish that I thought it was, you know, absolutely a genial idea. And that's how I met Zarela.
And I love the fact that you brought up Cafe Marimba, because, you know, I'm in meetings with all my team to expand our restaurants, and they ask me, what's the aesthetic that I want? And I think about Cafe Marimba with all the pastel colors and then the big wooden slats going over the bar. And the bar
was very modern. It was very modern. It was Barragán, you know?
And you know, there are hardly any photographs of it. I have some photographs, but there are hardly any photographs. But I have to, before we get off of Recado Rojo, I want to tell the story. You know, when we did that conference in Greystone, where we had the regional Mexican food, remember? Mm-hmm. And Silvio Campos opened the with the first lunch, and he had.
I remember Silvio Campos.
And he had, you know, the cochinita pibil, and he made the siglipac, and he made all this amazing Yucatecan, and that was our first lunch. And we brought him in afterwards to recognize him at this, and he started to cry, and cry and cry and cry and cry. He couldn't stop crying, and finally he contained himself, and he said, I thank the Culinary Institute of America for giving me the opportunity to put the name of my community so high.
That was beautiful. Yeah.
I remember it. And for me, it was great to see him because I met him in his community. And, he taught me how to do cochinita pibil. I just was there and I saw the whole process. And throughout that experience, he was wearing a very well-ironed and very prim chef's jacket.
Filipina.
And I was like, oh my God. Because he had been to Chicago before. And I think that, you know, he got the chef's. So he was very proud of being a chef, you know, more than, although he was, to me, it was a pit master.
A pit master, exactly. A
pit master, extraordinary. And I remember distinctively, you know, that experience at the Culinary Institute of America. But he was the master of the Recado Rojo. And to me, you know, the Recado Rojo is really one of the great uses of achiote.
And let's talk about what is achiote and what is it? Yeah.
Achiote is a nato seed.
Mm-hmm. But let's talk a little bit about what's more added to it, though.
Well, vinegar or sour orange juice, cumin, maybe some of the Cuban oregano.
Allspice.
But let's make the delineation so people that are listening, so you would get an achiote.
I know, ma'am.
Espérame. a recado rojo or an achiote paste. What does that consist of? And,
your mother told you already, you would have to add, if you buy it in the market, obviously, it's not easy to make a recado at home because it requires the grinding of the soaked achiote seeds.
Yep.
All right. And you cannot do it with mortar and pestle because it needs to be very smooth. Mm-hmm, all right. Mm-hmm. So normally people go to the market and they get recado rojo. When I learned how to make it in Mérida with a very, wonderful cook, she was an elderly woman in her 80s when I met her. She's probably, gone now. She would get the paste, but then at home, she would add more spices. She would
and roasted garlic?
Spice. Pardon me?
Roasted garlic or no?
Yes. And she would add all these things, and she would add naranja agria, the bitter orange to it, at home, and more allspice. So I think I wrote that in Gran Cocina, that anecdote, because most people do that. They just they buy the stuff because of that. It's a paste already. It's easy to work with. And at home, they add more things to it. And they refresh flavors at home.
And that's what we do at the restaurants, by the way. We buy el yucateco, whatever, if we're pressed for time.
Buy the achiote paste, right?
Yeah, the achiote paste. And that's a way to doctor it up. And I think it's important to people there that people that are listening, if you don't have sour orange, a good tip is to use equal parts of orange and lime, right? To, as a quick substitute. If you
and a little bit of grapefruit too.
And grapefruit as well. If
you're not taking certain medicines say no grapefruit.
Yeah. Oh, any statins. If you're taking statins, you cannot take grapefruit. But although people, you know, they do that.
Yeah, I'm just saying so people can embrace the food, everyone, and be able to cook it at home. Okay, this is kind of what we're trying to get accomplished as part of all that. It's just we want people to embrace our flavors, understand how to take those concepts and bring them into their home kitchen. So
but the base is something that, you know, I've tried to do it at home, and it's been very difficult for me to get that creamy.
Because you have to grind the seeds in a coffee grinder.
Yeah, and then but it has to be moist, and I think it takes time. So I think if you want people to cook with this, is maybe to get the achiote paste and then add all the other ingredients.
I agree.
Well, I want you to know that I have a recipe on my website, www.sarela.com, for cochinita pibil. Using arrecadero.
Well, I think that should be the beginning for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, cochinita pibil is a dream. Mm. And if you cannot do the whole pig, although if you have a cajachina, you can kind of do that in the middle of winter. But with ribs, you know, with meaty ribs, oh my God, and just all, you know, smother in the recado rojo.
And there was
and then you can
pickle red onions.
You can wrap it in planting banana leaves, right?
And then afterwards, you pickle some red onions. Make
I'm so hungry right now.
A pico de paloma, which is made with habaneros and not jalapenos.
You know what? Pico de paloma, tell me about it, because I, you know, for some reason, it escapes me right now.
It's like a pico de gallo. It's like a pico de gallo, but you use sour orange juice, and you use habaneros instead. And red onions. Yeah, you make a pico.
That sounds amazing.
It's amazing because of the.
If I may, ladies, if we can talk a little bit, if we can talk a little bit about it. So if you get a recado recado rojo, recado negro, lo que sea, what's the marinating time that you would do that with, right? So if you have a pig, right, or a pork shoulder, let's say that's more applicable to what people would get home. What is the marinating time, ladies, in your opinion?
Minimum 4 hours, preferably overnight cover type.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. But also remember that you're going to be cooking also that meat slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is another process. You know, sometimes you don't need to be marinating for so many hours. 4 hours is fine sometimes because you're going to be wrapping this meat in banana leaves, and it's going to cook slowly. You're not going to rush the process. So there is a moment there for that goodness to penetrate the meat. And I think that if you over marinate, then you overpower the flavor of the meat. And I don't think we want that. The recados to be enhancers, but not something that will dominate flavor experience.
Well, you know, the thing is that the pork here doesn't taste like anything.
So let's go for the recado then instead of the pork.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's tiki bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
So then, Mommy, do you have some questions for Chef Maricel?
What are you working on now?
What am I working on? I'm working on survival.
Well, that's what I...
I had to close my restaurants.
I know.
Because of the pandemic. And for me, it's been, a learning curve to live without them. Also, I'm doing just about everything. I used to have help, and now I'm essentially doing everything. Becoming very, almost self-sufficient, I'm doing, in terms of cooking, I'm cooking more than ever. I'm cooking, 3 meals a day, 7 days a week. I send my husband with his food to take to the office, because he's a first responder, he's a physician. So he's been working throughout the pandemic. So he goes with his food. To me, that has been the silver lining, the fact that I am doing so much cooking and doing a lot of new recipes, exploring other cuisines besides Latin American. I do a lot of my shopping in Korean and Japanese markets. So I have been cooking a lot of Japanese and Korean food.
Rodrigo, my other son, cooks a lot of Japanese food.
Mm-hmm. So, I go to these markets weekly. And so, I mean, that's the silver lining, the fact that I make my own bread, I ferment. So I'm doing so much more as a home cook and really enjoying that part. And in fact, I have to tell you, you can't see me because, you can't see me, but I've lost a lot of weight.
You look fantastic.
I mean, I'm down, many dress sizes. So my husband has lost weight. So it's the fact that we're home and I'm cooking very deliberately things that are good for us without obsessions, obviously, but exploring different ways of eating. A lot of whole grains and, very interesting, plant forward foods. And also enjoying, the peppers that I grew in my garden in the summer, which I ferment, I dry, talking about spices, we can't forget chiles, the capsicums, because, they might be used as vegetables and to add texture to a dish, for example, in a mole, but they're also spices, think about chipotle.
Yeah. I just discovered beans, like real beans. Because we had Steve Sando from Rancho Gordo. It's amazing. I really had not cooked beans that much. I just got my new delivery of ayocotes.
Oh, the ayocotes are amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, in Puebla, they make like the best ayocotes. Morelos,
How do they do them? Because in Oaxaca, they make them with coloradito. How do they do them in Puebla?
They make them with chiles also, it's a stew. And, with other ingredients, some oregano, some cumin, it's just delicious. It's very creamy.
Mm-hmm.
Ayocotes. I haven't tried Steve's, but I might order.
Oh, you should.
I think it's
spectacular.
But, beans not improve because they're great, but they benefit from the use of spices. And in fact, I used to do a lot of the sofritos, for my bean soups.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I have discovered is that sometimes you don't need that you can add things raw in different stages while you're cooking the beans, and it's just perfect. I have these beautiful clay pots, and I just, I add my chile paste, different types of chiles, the oregano, the cumin. Whatever.
You keep on mentioning cumin, and usually cumin in Mexican food is like, no, que se vaya el diablo, que venga Dios.
You know, I adore cumin. I have to tell you this, Arela. I mean, give me all the cumin in the world because I just cannot live without that spice.
Oye, mijo, you've been very quiet today. Are we over?
I'm with the two strong Latinas. What am I going to do? I'm going to have to be very respectful and very generous.
Sobrino, you can say whatever you want. Please. I want to hear your voice.
No, I just think it's interesting. I just think, you know, the idea of, you know, talking about the seasoning paste and how to preserve spices, I think that's important. I think one of the things that I do is I try to buy whole spices at all times and then toast them yourself and then be able to grind them yourself and have dates and seasoning paste that you can make on your own. You know, I think that's something important that the home cook should know. And you should also recycle all your spices. If it's been in that cupboard for too long, then you're not utilizing it. So things like that that our listeners can get around, you know, and make your little
seasoning. Talking about the paste, the iron, I don't know if you do that, but I imagine you do, and Sarela, you too. It's using different moles, you know, as seasoning ingredients, you know, not thinking about that great pot of mole, but having them as a seasoning paste. I use mole.
Yeah, me too. Sauces.
You know,
beans, for example.
Well, we did at the restaurant that was very interesting is once we made, you know, and that's interesting. You brought up mole, tía, but the idea is like you don't pass a mole, you don't put it through a sieve, right? But what we've done if we've gotten, you know, chihuahua negros and we're making mole negro, sometimes we will pass a little bit and then take that residual chile and seasoning and thickening and dry that out in the oven. And so we have this mole seasoning paste that we
use. A very good idea.
That's a great idea. I love it. And so you get chilhuacle, Aaron? You get chilhuacle? Where are you getting it?
It's very expensive. So that's why we don't do it very often. But, you know, the gentleman, the chili guy in New Mexico gets me some on occasion. But the idea is like taking all the residual mole and all the grind and then toasting that overnight and then using it as a seasoning for steaks.
Okay, so when you're making a mole and when you're straining the mole, just keep that and then, you know, layer it on a baking sheet and dehydrate that.
Yeah, dehydrate that. And then you can buzz.
I love that.
And then you can mix that with salt and then use that as a finishing for a grilled steak, for instance.
Well, you know,
to crust some lamb, you know.
That sounds like fantastic.
Crust lamb with that? God, I love that.
Yeah. So,
well, see, with me, it's different because what I do for the chilies, because they're so hard to strain, what I do is that I toast the chilies before I put them together. I put them in the oven, toast them slowly until they have that little sweetness, let them cool, and then I grind them. And that's very easy to add to the mole paste. You know, when you have
it. Oh, you do that. I don't. I mean, that's a you know, different way of doing things.
I sometimes soak them, but it's so much easier to do it this way. And it adds that toasted, wonderful feeling, you know. I mean, try it.
Guys, what are your favorite moles? What is your favorite moles, Arela?
Mole de Jico. I have that on my page right now.
From my webpage.
No, from Veracruz.
From Veracruz, Aaron, and yours?
I love my mole negro from Oaxaca, por supuesto, con chihuacle. But I really am starting to learn about the different iterations of the mole poblano. It's probably the most celebrated mole in at least in the States. And I started to learn all the different nuances behind it, how much of the chili guajillo you use versus this. So I'm really starting to get into the most iconic mole, which is the poblano. You know?
That's good.
But, you know, I mean, talking about spices, that's the perfect example of how spices were deployed, you know, in the colonial period, you know, when moles took the shape that, you know, we know today.
When I went to Puebla, I went to Piaxla. And I had a completely different mole from when I went to Tetla, for instance, another little town in Puebla. I had two.
So what was the difference, Aaron? What was the difference?
I mean, the difference was the sweeteners, I thought. And I thought also you know, one particular region used a lot more chocolate, and then one region actually put, instead of the traditional bread or the thickener, they use, of all things, animal crackers. And the animal crackers gave a really beautiful sweetness to it. And I was like blown away.
You remember that time that in that same conference, mm-hmm. that it was Yolanda Serrano, mm-hmm. and Roberto Santisteban was Santibáñez was translating. Mm-hmm. And yes, they said, vas a la tienda y compras las galletas más corrientes. And so, and he was speaking English.
The most ordinary crackers.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. he was speaking in English. He says, you go down the aisle of your supermarket, and you come to the biscuit section, and you look at one of them, and you say, my God, how cheap.
No mames.
So he said that at that conference.
Oh,
so
my
we're all laughing. My God.
I love, you know, mole for me has become, you know, I had to, you know, work very hard to understand the organization, you know, of the mole ingredients when I was writing my mole chapter mm-hmm. for Gran Cocina Latina. And then for, you know, my last book, Peppers of the Americas, I think I had learned something by then. So my mole coloradito is something that I really like.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you, you know, these are my best friends in the kitchen. So I have this mole paste mm-hmm. in the refrigerator. And when I'm cooking, you know, maybe even a rice dish that I need, you know, instant seasoning, I just, you know, I add a spoonful or so of, you know, of mole. And I get this beautiful reddish seasoned rice, you know.
Oh, that's a good idea.
I use it as a marinade for things.
I use the paste. I make like a lasagna, well, not a lasagna, a layered casserole with plantains, cooked plantains, ground up, a smearing of the mole paste. And then black beans.
What mole paste do you use for that?
Puebla.
And
I just put it like that, or whatever I have. And then another layer of beans, and then at the end, another layer of the plantain. It's fantastic.
So if people knew, you know, how to use mole beyond, you know, the iconic, you know, big pot of mole, you know, with the turkey and whatever, they would be making moles more often. Because I think nothing beats the complexity of some of these moles. And to me, they exemplify, you know, what we were talking about today, you know, the use of spices that influence from the old world, the combination of the new world ingredients such as chiles,
tomato,
you know, and
tomato.
Spices. It's brilliant.
I know.
Yeah. And one of the things I would love to rehash and maybe bring up for a new episode, Tia, I want to talk about rice. And I would love to have you, and my mom would love to have you back on to talk about rice dishes. And I think that's something that has been completely misunderstood and underappreciated. So I think we're going to have to do that for the next one.
Okay, baby.
I'd love to do that. And I have to say that this has been such a pleasure for me.
Oh.
You know, in a day that, you know, an unexpected pleasure, it's so welcome.
Thank you so much. Well, we love having
digging out from the snow, seeing your passion undiminished and your understanding enlarged, you know, by time and experience. You know, this is, and it's, this is useful. Yeah. You know, these conversations are useful because now I just feel like I want to pick your brains because, you know, we're talking about different ideas, you know, this dehydration of the residue and the use of it for, you know, to create other things. Sarela talking about that lasagna, you know, with and plátanos then, and mole.
And Marisa, and then toasting your chiles and your vegetables and putting them into your soaking liquid for your beans to create that other layer of flavor. You know what I mean? Boom, boom,
yes.
Boom, you know?
I have to try that because you're really into that.
I don't understand through, you know, if they get anything from our conversation is that our food is very complex.
Yeah.
You know, I'm proud of this complexity because obviously, you know, we're always reminded that other cuisines are so complex and, you know, that they have this, you know, these protocols and, you know, I'm talking about French cuisine and things like that. But my God, look, you know, look at the ingredients of a recado negro and a recado rojo, the time it takes to prepare these things, the complexity of flavor, aroma, and texture. Mm-hmm. Think about the moles and their many uses. Isn't that extraordinary? What does it tell you about us? I mean, we're fabulous cooks. I mean, this layering is the mark of great
Latin cooking.
And we have
to go.
We have to go, but I just want to say that we all know that our Gran Cocina Latina is it's a matriarchal cuisine. Women dominate, and women have always been the guide and the center force of our cuisine. So to have both of you here is a complete honor. So we want to thank Maricel Presilla. Thank you so much for joining us. If you want to really delve deep in all things Latin cuisine-based, please look up her book, La Gran Cocina Latina. It's literally the Bible of all things beautiful and delicious in our beautiful cuisine. So please make sure you look up Maricel Presilla. And we want to thank you so much, tia. Gracias.
Thank you, baby.
Gracias to you, sobrino, and mi hermanita Zarela.
Okay, love baby. Lots of love. Lots of love.
Cooking in Mexican from A to Z is powered by Simple Cast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without your support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.